This is Bragg, son of Balin, and you're listening to Light the Beacons, a LOTRO podcast. Welcome to the world of Middle-earth.
Shall answer.
Hello and welcome everybody to another episode of Light the Beacons, a LOTRO podcast focusing on the Tolkien-esque MMORPG, Lord of the Rings Online, as well as related topics in books, movies, gaming, and the lore of the aforementioned J.R.R. Tolkien. This is episode number 3, Return of the Jedi, Grey Company, and I'm your host, Bragg of the Lonely Mountain, Ridge Racer, and Dwarf of Ill Repute. You know what they say. Third time's the charm. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice. Three is a magic number, etc. Well, we better get on with it. There's so much time and so little to do. Wait, stop that. Reverse it. And light our first beacon. Amandine. Well, it's official. We are no longer shouting into the void. If you're from Hanover, New Hampshire, my vox is not clematising in deserto. I actually have listeners out there. Suddenly it's a burden. Thanks to all those that provided encouragement, any comments, feedback, general support from the last week. It's very exciting for me. My topic of Moria incited some passion in some of the comments, as it often does in-game. There are those that hate it. There are those that love it. Few straddle the fence. They enjoy it like an old friend when they're in there, but they're certainly happy to see the light of day when they peek out into the veils of Lothlorien, and most people get upset when you talk to a few elves, and they send you right back down into the pit. But I think it's been a diverse topic throughout LOTRO's history, so I was glad to touch on it and hear some of your feedback. I really appreciate it. I also got some additional comments regarding audio issues. I understand that I'm growing in my capacity to be professional with Audacity, and I'm not talking about the Moore's Audacity. I'm talking about the podcasting software. Dwarves are short enough without only being in one ear, so I think I've corrected that this time around. Hopefully that adds to your enjoyment of the podcast. Again, apologies. This is a learning process for me. Hopefully each week will get a little bit better, and if there are additional issues that you note, please do continue to let me know. I do appreciate it. Hoping to make it a little easier on your ears from here on out. Have some corrections from last week. From time to time, I'm going to make some mistakes. I think I have a pretty good knowledge of Tolkien lore and the game in general, but what I found is that often when you're podcasting, although you know the stuff inside out, the words don't exactly come to mind as you're speaking into your microphone. So you could be sitting there saying, what is that place where the hobbits hang out and it's there's trees and grass and stuff? Oh, what do they call it again? Oh, yeah, the Shire. So apparently your brain collapses. Other podcasters will tell you that happens from time to time. So last week I did at one point talk about the beacon Callan had, and I mentioned it was a namesake of the ranger Callan Glad from Tunudur and Evendim. And Callan Glad obviously is not the same as Callan had. So I just wanted to let you know that I caught that when I was listening to myself later, and I did correct it. The other correction I have from last week, apparently Maud Falsham is not a Jewish delicacy served during a bris. So there you have it. Moving on. In this week's episode, we're actually going to list real stuff on our agenda for a change. We're going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in-game, including a few tips and tricks I learned about big battles this week. I have a new segment we're going to be premiering where I can espouse some random thoughts. intend to get our hands dirty with a new segment where we talk a little bit about different combat mechanics, and I expect a lively discussion on the appropriateness of bringing little pet Huorns into the workplace. As ever, there's much to talk about, so let's light the second beacon. Ilenoch. Okay, this week in Lotro, I want to discuss a little bit about what I've been doing in-game, including some game tips and instance strategies when applicable. So I've, of course, been continuing with Fangorn dailies. I am quickly approaching, well, not quickly, I am approaching, though, friend status. So beyond that, or ally status, I should say, and beyond that, kindred still awaits. So it's going to be a slow process. It's going to be a couple weeks. Still over, as far as I can remember, 8 on end presence at this point with Huorns, although that was slightly mollified by something that happened later that I'll share with you down further in the podcast. I did actually was inspired to go out and log into my champion, which I have not done in quite some time. He's in his mid-30s, and what attracted me, of course, was that he was sitting in Esteldin. Or Esteldin, as I like to call it. So he's primed to be able to experience some of the changes from the revamp of the North Downs. And I wanted to at least try a few things out and see how they felt. You know, oftentimes when I go to an alt, I'll quest around for a day or two, get a level, and then quit for a while as I'm lured back to endgame. But sometimes a spark will ignite, and I'll stick with that character for a bit and push him through a couple decades. We'll see how my champion fares moving forward. But as far as my experiences in the North Downs, you know, some of the quests obviously were very familiar, but with slightly different twists. For example, the quest line on just outside the western entrance to Esteldin, spiders in the snares, used to be a bunch of quests you'd collect around inside the camp and then go out and you know, collect all two or three of them at once. Kill the spider queen, find the gem pouch, kill 10 spiders, etc. So now there's one quest to find the gem pouch that's in Esteldin, and the rest are remotely bestowed as you enter the area. So bringing some of the tech from the further releases back into the North Downs as part of the revamp, as we expected. I would say it's slightly more convenient. It gives a little cleaner interface to the rings in the camp. You don't have to run to three or four different guys to grab them all. Maybe bechance miss one and then finish the whole area and then have go back and find that you missed one quest that was from the area. I've done that before. So I would say that is an upgrade. Also rescued the Oryx near Gatson's Farm. Saved Gatson's Farm again. Those guys just refuse to move. I don't know what's up with them. Collected some herbs around the country from Orthon. When I was talking to Orthon, the ranger that's near the river that splits the North Downs in half, he sent me on a quest to go deal with some wolves a little northwest of his location, and I don't believe I remember that quest being there before, so that may be some new content that's out there that I hadn't seen as far as looking through some bone piles for some dwarves that might have wandered away. So it's good to see some additional quests. That was an area kind of northeast of Stone Heights that really didn't have a lot of content before, so glad to see they were maybe filling in some of the areas with some extra stuff. There were some additional remote quests as I walked around. I saw mobs with rings over their heads that could start some Slayer quests. And that's about all I did in Esteldin. Gained another level. My champion, I can't remember his exact level. He's somewhere in the low to mid-30s. So I did see some quests in the west in around Minchum that were in the 25 to 30 range, which he's already passed. So I expect it's not going to take long for him to accelerate through that area. Unless I elect to stop and smell the roses, which with an XP disabler, which I don't intend to do. I've got other alts below my champion that can come up and experience some of that content as well. But if I continue to press through there, I'll let you know what else I think about the area. But so far, you know, a few convenience items, but nothing big. Okay, so what else did I do last week? I did a big battle on my lore master. He's in the epic quest line trying to get his first instance of each big battle out of the way so he can get through the epic quests. And I would note that soloing big battles on a lore master is a little easier than on a guardian, I would say. you know, you're not often in a situation where you have to endure a lot of damage like a guard would. You don't have the aggro for a guard, which seems to be hit or miss in some of those instances as to who you can affect with some of those things. But as an LM, I've got, you know, I've got a various cadre of mezzes, slows, stuns, which did seem to help, as well as my pet to give me a hand. So I did find some of the side quests easier on an LM than I would on my guardian. For example, in the Deeping Coom, I got the Dark Water quest where the Dark Waters are spawning and coming out of the pool, and I found that from range I was able to mez some of the Dark Waters that I wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. And as I was taking care of them, I was able to sick my pet on some of the defilers that were sitting further back in the water and maintain range. So I think, you know, that's a quest where having a mez helps. Having a lot of range skills helps, so you don't have to run all the way into the water to melee some of the defilers that are near the back while Dark Waters are slipping past you. You know, again, it would be nicer if they made it equitable amongst all the classes, but I understand how that's not possible. So... so far, doing solo big battles on an LM a little easier, and hopefully I'll be done with that first instance soon. Not planning on doing a multitude of big battles on my LM over time, but you know, want to stick with that with my main for now, but we'll see. Then I did run a six-man dike on my main, Brag, and learned a few things in this running of it that I hadn't learned about in the previous iterations. So we had someone in the party that had done some of these infinitum and knew a bit more about it than some of us. We got the Protect the Horses quest, which is, in my experience, usually a tough one to platinum. And one of the things I learned, one of the reasons I probably never platinumed it as a solo before, is that at the very beginning of the quest, apparently Dunlendings slip up behind the stables. There's two horses that are stabled behind the stable, and either two or three Dunlendings spawn, at least in the six-man version, and they attack those horses in the back. It's the only wave that attacks the back of the stables, and if you don't run there right away as soon as the quest begins, those two horses that are back there get driven off. And I never even knew they were back there, and I never knew that Dunlendings spawned from behind the stables. So next time you're running a six-man and you get the Protect the Horses quest, run behind the stables first and drive off those first two Dunlendings, and then those two horses are in the bag and you can focus up front. So that's something I learned this week. We also got the side quest for War Machine at the gates, and at least in the six-man, one other thing that I learned is that there are two minor War Machines on either side of the gate. So not only do you need to pick up arrows and make sure all the archers in the top are firing on the main War Machine, but you need people down at the gate DPSing away at the two minor War Machines that are in either side of it, or you will lose the quest as well. So that's something I learned again this week. Also learned something about the firing of ballistas that I didn't know before. I guess that makes them slightly more attractive in some circumstances. Apparently, ballistas target, if you fire them at a big group of mobs, they apparently target the elite mobs first, so typically commanders or trolls, which you'd like to burn down more quickly anyway. So that makes them slightly more useful for certain side quests where burning down the trolls is perhaps more important, something like protecting the Helm's Dyke statue or Helm of Hammerhand statue on the dyke. You know, sometimes you set up a ballista at the opening to that area to help out with that as well. So the other thing I think I learned about big battles a little bit was that, you know, what I'm finding is that typically when I group, there's two main categories of people. There are what I'd call platinum veterans. They're only rerunning big battles to try to platinum the instance in order to potentially earn a symbol of the Elder King or, you know, get a platinum reward item. And so often when you run with people that are only looking for that, you know, if you mess up one side quest or one small part of the main quest, they'll advocate jumping out of the instance and starting over, which I'm fine with. You know, I'd like to earn a good result too. And then the other people that, you know, often compose a group are some neophytes that really don't know the side quests, haven't been here before, don't know where to stand. So, you know, there's this dichotomy when you're pugging, at least, where, you know, the platinum veterans expect everyone kind of to know what to do already, and the neophytes really don't know what to do already. You know, there's sort of an expectation that big battles don't require the coordination that an instance does in order to be effective, and I don't think that's true. If you really are interested in Platinum. You should be, you know, if you and you know the side quests, you should be directing people a bit more specifically if you're the most knowledgeable person out there. You know, certainly communication always helps, which isn't always great in Pugs, but, you know, if you step forward and do it, every little bit helps. You know, what I found is often someone will say, you know, there's no one on the fourth gate. There's no one on the fourth gate. Someone get to the fourth gate, or whatever the case may be. And since they're not calling out names specifically, either no one goes because they think they're in an important area and doing something important, or everyone goes. So, you know, I think that's, you know, a common problem. You know, it does take a little more effort to, you know, mouse over someone's dot, realize they're in the wrong spot, give them advice if they don't know where they're going. You know, that's why I think it is important to run these things maybe at least once or twice or experience all the side quests before you start to group, unless you're with a kin or a bunch of friends that you know are going to give you the right guidance. One thing I did notice about the six-man Helm's Dyke instance is that for some reason we were getting no medallions or seals for rewards out of the six-man, which I think is a bug. So I'm not sure if anyone else has experienced that. If you have, let me know. And the other thing that was annoying coming out of it, yet another annoying thing about big battles, is that as my major reward coming out of it, I got a duplicate piece of jewelry. And I know they switched up the jewelry with the new release, update 13.1, to give people you know, more incentive to go back and more chance to win, you know, new rewards that are meaningful. At the same time, I think this is an issue that they could probably easily address. You know, what if, here's Bragg fixes Lotro again, what if instead of a specific jewelry drop, you know, if you achieved platinum on the overall instance or on a side quest, you received a coin of the Hammer Hand, and then you were able to go to a barter veteran in Helm's Deep and choose the jewelry item that you wanted, whether it cost one coin or a few, depending on how valuable or rare it was. That way you wouldn't be dealing with the duplicate jewelry items. Yes, it would take a little incentive to away from running the instances you know, repeatedly to try to win some items that you haven't had before, but I think all in all it would make most of the players happier. So let me know what you think about that idea, if you see a problem with it or if you agree. Okay, lastly, a last-minute addition to the podcast. Lucky I waited another day because the Spring Festival opened up. And, of course, I logged in and did a few things there. Since I've done most of the festivals and a lot of the deeds attached to the festivals, or at least most of the ones I care to do, generally I'm interested in getting the latest festival steed for my main character, Bragg, out of a sense of obligation. I am a bit of a horse collector. I don't know how many I've had. It's probably in the 50s or 60s at this point, which is kind of silly when you think about it. But I did have some leftover tokens from last season, which I was able to immediately buy what's called the Lisween Steed, I'd pronounce it. Thought it was pretty. Well done. It's got kind of a greenish starry cloak on it. Not bad. I'm going to have to grind a little bit for the coins for the other steed, the Steed of Garden Days or something like that. I glanced through the cosmetics, and I did notice one that I really liked. It's called the Cymbeline Cloak. So Cymbeline, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is the flower that grows upon the tombs of the Rohan, the kings of Rohan, outside the main gates of the main gates of Edoras. So I thought that would actually was a really nice design, so I may try to grind for that too. What I'd really like to see, knowing that I have 50 or 60 horses, here's an idea for the game. What if there was a random horse mounting skill where when you pressed H or a different key, it would randomly choose from amongst all your mounts, so it was kind of cycling through them over time for you versus having to open up the skills panel and pick a different one. Sounds like an easy Lua plug-in. Come on, Lua guys, get at it. My second idea around horses that would allow you to appreciate all the different options that you have is something I was hoping they might take a look at when they were looking at housing improvements. Of course, those have gone by the wayside now, but the idea was to attach a stables to your home. So say there's a door in the back of your house, and as you open it up, there's a long hallway where all the horses you've collected are displayed in stalls, one after the other. You could walk through and compare them and maybe hand one an apple or something like that. You know, even if it was, you know, every six or seven horses you went through another door and it extended out to show you another six or seven or whatever the case may be, if it was kind of ridiculous to have all 50, 60 in one kind of long instance. But think it would be a great way to have players appreciate what they've achieved as far as mounts in the game. So listen up, Turbine. I know, like the Little True Reporter guys say, this is probably being piped through the Turbine offices in Boston, so I'm sure they'll get right on that. Next note about the Spring Festival, and again, I didn't read, I'm sure CSTM has a guide out there already, but I didn't get a chance to look at it yet because it snuck up on me. But I was running through the hedge maze once real quick, and whoa, hold on. They changed the hedge maze. I started running my pattern, and I was in the center of it where the people are drinking out of the keg and hanging out partying, and I'm like, wait a second. That's not how you get here. What happened? First time I can remember in the game after 6 or 7 years that they've actually changed the layout of the hedge maze. So big news. You know, wouldn't think it would take a lot of effort to do that, but they've never done it before. So anyway, great move to at least keep that a little bit fresh. Wish they would do that for every festival going forward. So good job, Turbine, on that one. And lastly, a quest area that I know a lot of people don't like about the Spring Festival, collecting flowers. And there's a lot of problem with this quest. I understand why people don't like running around and spending an hour collecting flowers when they could be doing other things. But I did have leftover flowers from last year. So in two of the three flower categories, I had 20 or 30 tokens. So I just wanted to grind the last one a little bit, trade in for some presents, and see if there were some rewards for this festival I wasn't aware of that might be cool. So I ran out the West Gates of Bree. My spot in Bree is hanging out kind of near the Red Circle just across the bridge and looking out over the fields there. If I'm doing something else, typically there's maybe 3 or 4 different flower patterns that'll spawn, you know, right close by, so I don't have to go running around. I can just tap on them when they pop up. And lo and behold, as I was harvesting some marigolds, somehow, lost in the bushes, I found a Tomb of the Shrew. So when I double-clicked on the Tomb of the Shrew, I had my very own shrew, spotted shrew companion that popped up and started following me around. So Hugh Orange first. From Hobnanigans, we have the chickens. And now we have shrews from the Spring Festival. So Turbine appears to be wasting no time in introducing additional pets into the game. And so far, all three of them earnable in-game. I haven't looked down the Lotro stores to see if you can get them there from there as well. But I was a little surprised that I got the Tomb of the Shrew so easily, my first time out collecting flowers. If I hadn't collected flowers yet and I heard that was a prize, that might have incented me to go out and give it another try, even though it's not the best quest in the world. One thing I was not excited about, unless I'm missing some kind of key on it, I think this has to do with the fact that the pet is a client-side pet, is that I don't appear to be able to rename him unless there's some option that I'm missing somewhere. Like all my Lore Master pets or horses or heralds or RK rocks, you can rename. But my shrew did not appear to have an option to rename, which is really a shame because I already had one picked out. I was going to call him Stompers. So ran into Bree to show off my shrew, and a couple people did pop up and go, "Hey, that's cool. Where'd you get that?" But within 30 seconds of me parading around near the West Gate, someone else popped up with another shrew right next to me, which makes me think the drop rate on them, you know, being that it's the first day out, isn't going to be quite that rare, which is good, I guess, that people can get out and get some. I'd like it to be maybe a little more rare than everyone having one in the next couple days, but, you know, might have been luck for that other guy as well. So we'll wait and see how prevalent they are. But I actually thought the little guy was kind of cute. What do I know? All right, that's about enough for what we've been doing in-game this week. Let's move on to our third beacon. Nardal. Okay, for our third beacon, Nardal, we're going to premiere a new segment on the podcast, which is called Bragg's Grab Bag. Say that 5 times fast. I'm going to try. Ready? Bragg's Grab Bag, Bragg's Grab Bag, Bragg's Grab Bag, Bragg's Grab Bag. I knew that was going to be a problem. So, Bragg's Grab Bag is an amusingly eclectic menagerie of random and non-sequitur thoughts, observations, and anecdotes from the game. Basically, a bunch of random topics that I thought of this week that I wanted to mention and share with you. So, I was listening to Lotro Players this past week, and they had a segment about amusing bugs in the game. And as I was considering amusing visual bugs in the game, these are bugs that don't affect gameplay and are not intended. but maybe somewhat amusing in some way. And one that popped into my head was, and hopefully this is not just me, but do you ever notice when you're roaming the plains of Rohan and you find, come upon a solitary horse sitting, you know, sitting in the grass somewhere, what are they always doing when they first pop up on your screen? Maybe it's just my graphics card, I don't know. But before they catch you looking, of course, at least in my viewpoint, they always have their tails stretching straight out, lifted up as if they're taking a big dump. And then as soon as you get closer, it's like they're ashamed and they notice and they go, oh, he caught me, and they drop their tails. So shame on you, wild stallions. But I do find that kind of amusing as I prance around Rohan to see all the horses, you know, fertilizing the fields so unabashedly. Second, I did want to note that I saw my first chickens yesterday in the crafting hall in Aldberg. I particularly liked the one whose name was Fried. So I'm not sure if that's a randomly assigned name or if that was if you're able to change your name on the chickens and not on the shrews. But the companion was named Fried White Chicken, and he looked rather tasty, I must admit. So that brings me to another topic, amusing LOTRO pet names. Now, I don't prefer immersion-breaking tune names for your main characters. You know, I'm okay with it if they're at least clever and they're not offensive or inappropriate for kids. Occasionally, I will click on an inappropriate name if I think it's particularly offensive and report people like that. I do have friends who have kids who play the game, so I appreciate that. But I do think pets are fair game, and I've seen quite a number over time, you know, more names than I can remember that I found rather amusing. Here's a few of mine that I've picked out over time. My bear's name is Honey Lova. My bog guardian I've called Bogart, not Boggart, the little hobbity goblins from Manidwaith, but Bogart. My rabbit may be my favorite name of all time. It just popped into my head, and I enjoy it. His name is Isildur's Hare, H-A-R-E instead of H-E-I-R. My lynx's name is Cuff because, you know, Cuff Lynx, of course. I've got two different saber tooths. Their names are Snagglepuss and Can Opener. My turtle's name is Gamera, who, with the recent Godzilla craze, hopefully he'll make a comeback someday. He was always my favorite rubber-suited monster from Saturday morning movies back in the day. I've got a fox whose name is Cleopatra because Austin Powers fans will know Foxy Cleopatra. My frog's name is Frogo, which is a bit of an homage to Frodo, of course. And my squirrel, Nutbuster, which somehow passed the Turbine Code of Conduct policy. But I have seen some other ones out there, and I found a few online in a thread that I thought were amusing that I thought I'd share with you. I've seen lots of ravens with Edgar Allan Poe themes, either Nevermore, Quoth, or even Poe. I've seen bears named after the Chicago Bears, including the Fridge. One called Necessities, for Bear Necessities, of course. Blue being in the same vein. Fozzie, and my favorite, Waka Waka. My banner's name for my captain is Bruce, because. And I used to call my power banner Power Bar. I've also seen Ever Ready and Copper Top and all the other ones out there as well. My archer's name is Bald Arrow, because I've got that great skin that shows him like a monk with a bald head. I'm ashamed to admit I do have an archer as my main brag's skirmish shoulder, whose name is Legolas. And I know it's, you know, she's a female elf, and I know it's a little tired, but you know, it's the best I could do, and I haven't thought of something better. My lore master spirit's name is Figment. I have seen some amusing ones out there called Headlights and so forth. Runestones for RKs are a favorite. There's some good ones. You know, Rock of Ages, the Prudential was a good one. I saw one that I thought was particularly deadpan amusing called Scarn Deposit. Papa, Rolling Stone, of course. Tombstone, and Sham for Shamrock. For herbalists, mine's called Herbie, but I've also seen them called Lovebug, Ally McHeel, Viagra, or Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And sometimes the ones that make you think a little bit, just long enough to make you smile, like a horse whose name is Charlie. Bog Guardians whose name are Swamp Thing. A herald whose name is Hark. or a Patsy, of course, from Monty Python fame. And I've also seen a Captain's Herald called Antennial, which I found rather amusing. For skirm shoulders, I think Lotro Reporter's famous skirm shoulder is Doofus or Dingus or something like that. But I do like the ones that are called Kenny, so that when they die, you can yell out to your party, "They killed Kenny." I'm trying to keep the podcast PG, but I think you know the rest. Of course, when I created my captain way back in the day, I did try to name him Crunch, or every permutation I could think of Crunch. Of course, they were all taken. That ship had sailed. What a surprise. Okay, so let's continue in the grab bag, pulling out another thread. I've heard a number of podcasts and some in-game conversation talking about the upcoming splitting of the Fellowship, how best to handle that in-game. Frodo and Sam have gone off. We haven't seen them since the banks of the Anduin. And we really don't know what's going on with them right now. We're embroiled in Rohan and Helm's Deep, and that's where we needed to be. I think that was right. But I don't think it would be wise of Turbine to say we're not going to meet up with those guys again until after the ring is thrown in Mount Doom or even by the gates or whatever the case may be. And there was a hint dropped in a recent update indicating that there's going to be the Dead Marshes is coming in a landscape release or update at some point this year. So to me, that tells me we are going to be visiting Frodo and Sam as they venture east. And how can that be resolved in a way that's going to be satisfying for the players? So there's a couple options out there I've heard talked about. The first is to be a session play, perhaps as Gollum or even Sam, experiencing the walk through the Dead Marshes. I think those could work, at least to have us touch in with those guys. Dream sequence of some kind. Please don't make us go back to Elrond or Galadriel for that. But, they could figure out a way to do a dream sequence, with someone from the party like Gandalf or someone having a vision of what's going on with those guys. However, I have a better idea, and some people might consider it lore-breaking, some people might consider it not. I'd actually be happy with it if it came about. I think there's room for it in the lore. And the idea is that while the Rohirrim are marshaling their forces at Dunharrow, and Aragorn is setting off into the Paths of the Dead, I think there's a window for Gandalf to be worried about what's going on with Frodo and Sam, and to consider sending us on to check up with them. And the only way, obviously, that would work within the timelines is if we had some rather rapid accommodations available to us for transport. So I'm thinking either Shadowfax ride or an Eagle's ride. What if Gandalf summoned Gwaihir for us, and we mounted Gwaihir and rode east across the plains of Rohan, across the Anduin, and spotted Frodo and Sam in the Dead Marshes, and maybe did not get directly engaged with them, but as we're scouting for them, we clear a number of dangers that are lurking for them, or maybe follow in their footsteps, something that's been a formula that's worked in the past. So I think it would have to be handled really delicately, not to tromp on the lore. But, we're not talking about opening up eagle rides as a common mechanic in the game. It would have to be part of the epic quest line. It would be a kind of a one-time or two-time thing in order to get back. And, we know the devs can soar around in the game if they need to. So, I think it's possible. What if we rode an eagle to the Dead Marshes and experienced that zone either in front of or behind Frodo and Sam, in order to get a taste for what's going on there and touch in on their story a little bit? Maybe we'd come across a character like Gollum who could tell us what was going on with Frodo or Sam, or, some rangers who would see them, or even others. So just an idea that I had. You may hate it, you may like it. I think it would be fun. And one way to solve the problem without having to go to session play or dream sequences. Let me know what you think. Okay, so reaching into the grab bag, I wanted to note one thing I notice every time it happens. I love this effect in the game. My best landscape effect vote for Rohan at this point in time. The first time I experienced it was when I was in Hardwick, and obviously if you've been in that town, you know that near the bottom there's a large pool of water, which must be pretty scuzzy at this point, I gotta say. I don't think I'm gonna see any filtration systems on it, but be that as it may, the first time I was riding around in Hardwick, lo and behold, a troop of swans came soaring in and glided to a stop in the pool and started swimming. And I thought that was one of the coolest touches. You know, whatever Dev said, I can do this and it'll look cool and please let me spend the time to do it. Hats off. What a great effect. It's beautifully done. It's really cool. It's so immersive. And one of my favorite little touches about graphics in Rohan. And lastly in the grab bag this week, I've got a mini Bragg Fixes LOTRO segment. And this is an idea that I had while I was listening to an episode of LOTRO Academy a few weeks back where they were talking about Four Shell Quest Review and how we need excuses to go back to Four Shell occasionally. It's so far removed, it's kind of hard to weave it into the quest lines. Obviously, we got to go back there when we were in search of the Grey Company and finding Lothrandir, and that was great to revisit that zone. It's such a pretty zone. There's some great things about it. But we don't have a lot of ideas to go back there, and really, I don't see anything coming up in the game anytime soon that's going to present that opportunity. So one way to keep that zone fresh and to keep it involved in people's minds would be to, logically to me, involve it in somehow in the Winter Festival as it comes around. So I know we have a new zone in the game that's been Winterfell that's been around for a while, and that was a great addition. Lots of fun stuff to do there. But what if we took advantage of the winter zones in the game a bit more, such as Foreshell? I think it would be possible to create a stable pony that would bring you to an area maybe just north of... what's the main zone? It's Suri Kalia, I think, kind of above the ponds there where they've got the skirmish camp. If they surrounded it in a way that lobies could show up for the festival, I think it would be possible for us to experience a little bit of Foreshell. Heck, they could even put it at maybe out on, an island in the lake somewhere, right? They put an instance out there, so why not this? And my idea was this. What if they created a four-shell mirror maze out of ice? So we've got a hedge maze in the spring. We know that they can do reflective effects within the game. The first time I noticed a mirror was when the East End Met came out, and I walked into a little cabin where I saw a mirror hanging on the wall. Spent quite a lot of time looking at myself and trying to wave and so forth, and when I was a hobbit jumping up in the air so I could see in the mirror, which I thought was kind of amusing. And since then I've seen mirrors premiered around Bree, near some of the wardrobe areas as well. And I know in the epic quest instance where we find Ain Gunn with Lothrandir as part of the scooping up of the Grey Company, there's lots of kind of reflective, tall stalactites and stalagmites and walls of ice. So what if we made a reflective mirror maze, kind of a carnival mirror maze almost within the ice in Foreshell as a winter festival event? Let me know what you think about that idea. And the grab bag is empty. So let us move on to our fourth beacon. Erelos. Okay, now it's come to the part of the podcast where we have a word from our advertisers. This episode of Light the Beacons is brought to you by Barrow Brie. Barrow Brie, you won't need 12 Z's. Try Barrow Brie with mac and cheese. It makes a hobby tummy fill up with glee and poison. And by Thornley's Construction Company. Why run when you can walk? Why build when you can fish? Thornley's Construction Company, serving the Upper Valley community endlessly for over 7 years. And finally this week, I'm proud to announce we have a new sponsor, Helchgam's Spa and Beauty Salon Products. We'll give your skin that unnatural glow. Drop by and see us in the new Carn Doom Outlet Mall in Northern Angmar. There is plenty of parking. Thanks to all of our sponsors for your continued support of the podcast. With that, it is time to move on to our fifth beacon. Minriman. Okay, and Minriman this week, we're going to talk about another LOTRO quest highlight. This one's from the Broadacres. As you move through Stoke, and before you get to Woodhurst, there is a number of quests in an area called Torbury. And as you find the outcasts from Torbury and help them to counterattack the orcs that have taken over their town, You come across on an NPC that is accused by his peers of being mad. And he asks you in his stead to help verify some of his things that he's seen around the landscape, which have caused his peers to label him crazy. So this quest line is called Monsters or Madness. And it's an opportunity for casual raiding around the landscape. The rewards could use some work. I think, basically, when you go back and talk to him, you know, it's the usual. A little bit of rep, a little bit of item XP, whatever the case may be. You would think they could at least throw a deed on there. Maybe 5 measly turbine points for doing something that's kind of above and beyond and working with other players to accomplish something that's a bit more... exacting than a regular quest. You know, what if you had a title like Monster Hunter or Van Helsing Wannabe or something? I don't know. But basically, there are three legendary monsters around Rohan. First is the Guardian of the Shrine, which is kind of a spirit, giant spirit tiger or feline of some kind that sits above the Mead Hall in Woodhurst. You kind of got to work your way back up the hill. Nearby where the new path to the Entwood is, but a little to the left, basically, instead of to the right as you break through that area. And the first time through there, again, this is before the adjustments of 13.1, so I don't know how it would go now, but I was able to solo that guardian with my main brag as a guard. So Guardian took down the Guardian, and I was calling out in Unite Villa's GLFF channel for people to help, and someone showed up, I think, with about, a couple hundred XP left and got credit for the kill. But, I believe the XP for most of these monsters is somewhere in the, between 900K and 1.4 million range. So it certainly took a long time, but was able to reach equilibrium with self-heals and protective skills to be able to solo that. I don't know how that would go with the revamp. I'm imagining not as well, or at least I hope not. A raid-level monster should not be able to be soloed if it's in a cap-level area. That's found to be a little bit ridiculous. The second is a dragon in the West Fold, which is kind of east of Grimslade and west of Edoras, kind of... up on the mountain, in the foothills of the mountains there. Nothing special about him. We've all seen lots of dragons before. Or it might be a greater drake, I guess, since the only real dragons in the game are Dragok, Zombie, up in Heligrod, and whatever we've heard about Smaug, at least. And the last one is kind of a more interesting case, and I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly. I'm going to call it Fastitokalon. So let's talk about Fastitokalon. Not everyone in the game may know that Fastitokalon actually has its roots in the lore of J.R.R. Tolkien. There is a short poem in a book called The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, written by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is a collection of kind of short stories, poems, and prose that within the context of the lore are supposed to be translations from the Red Book of Westmarch, which is the book that that Bilbo handed down to Frodo, who handed it down to Sam to talk about the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit, there and back, the Hobbit adventures, etc. So this is additional text from that book, and the poem of Fastitokalon goes like this. And look, there is Fastitokalon, an island good to land upon, although 'tis rather bare. Come, leave the sea and let us run, or dance or lie down in the sun. Sea gulls are sitting there. Beware. Gulls do not sink. There they may sit or strut and prink. Their part is to tip the wink, if anyone should dare. Upon that isle to settle, or only for a while to get relief from sickness or the wet, or maybe boil a kettle. So what is Fastitokalon? Fastitokalon is a giant turtle. And from what I've seen in Wikipedia's online, the giant turtle submerges itself until only its shell sticks above the water. And people mistake it for an island and go and sit on it, and there's various growths and so forth sticking out of it. And then are either drowned as it goes under the waves or consumed by the monster itself. So in this case, Fastitokalon is a rather large turtle. Those of you who have done the Moria raid for Turtle Soup have probably seen something similar, a couple hundred times. So, silly little hobbits. It's probably not Festotokalon. It's probably just Nanu's dad. And he might be mad if he knew I'd killed his ex-wife about 70 babillion times, as Golden Star would say. But nice job, Turbine, in adding this to the quest options within the WestEmNet. It's different. It's interesting. It pays homage to Tolkien's works for those that care to go a little below the surface and discover a little bit more about it. Would be a little more exciting if the monsters took even a modicum of strategy beyond just getting enough people in your group to overpower them. But still, all the same, interesting and worth doing at least once. Okay, that's our LOTRO quest highlight for the week. It's time to move on to our sixth beacon. Kalanhad. Okay, so we're going to premiere a new segment for our sixth beacon this week, and it's called the Combat Mechanic of the Week. So it's first in what I'd like to do a series on over time of melee skills, or melee skills, as you like to call them. I always call it melee. I'm going to call it melee. I know it's melee. Don't correct me, please. If you are a newer player, I've called it melee, by the way, ever since I played Dungeons & Dragons, so it's hard for me to change from, you know, fourth grade. Sorry about that. If you're a newer player, aside from enjoying the story and the scenery, one of the most important things you can do as you level your character is to learn your skills as deeply as you can. Revisit the tooltips for the skill as frequently as possible until you have them memorized. And if the tooltip is vague, as they often are, go out to the forums if you can to understand all the skill effects and how it's typically used. So some of it's obvious. The damage done, the power cost, the cooldown. Most of that stuff you'll learn over time will come naturally as you build skill rotations at fights. However, many melee skills also have special components that you may or may not be aware of if you don't read them carefully. For example, this week's topic, corruption removal. So in this tip, we're going to talk about corruption removal and how to use it in combat. Skills that have corruption removal components do just that. They remove a dispellable corruption, usually represented by a small bright skull icon for the most dangerous ones that sits under the portrait of the mob that you're attacking. Not all corruptions are dispellable. There are some that are not. And learning which are which just takes some time, unfortunately. Typically, ones that are dispellable or that are not dispellable, like in a raid, you'll see on the monster even before the fight begins versus ones that they build up over time in the fight. So, on the landscape, without exception, I never worry about corruption removal. There's no landscape mob that you can fight, in my experience, where removing the corruption is more important than just doing damage and burning them down. And I think this is one of the reasons landscape combat can be boring. So LOTRO created a lot of knight's depth and character to combat by adding some of these combat components, like corruption removal, and then they neglect to use them in a meaningful way, except largely in instances and raids. I'd like to see landscape mobs have corruptions which were worth dispelling, which had consequence if you did not and actually endangered your character. So come on, Turbine, think about it. So a popular mechanic in many boss fights for instances and raids is to have a boss that stacks corruptions. Each corruption that stacks on the boss is typically a buff or a debuff that makes the mob tougher to fight. So popular ones including things like taking decreased melee damage or increasing their attack speed or damage output, etc. So one or two corruptions on a mob, generally not an issue. But if you're fighting a mob that generates them as part of their skill rotation, and they start to get 5 or 6, etc., they can get to the point where they can one-shot your tank. Or maybe the mob's not taking any damage at all, and when the next wave of adds comes, you're going to be in big trouble. So it's in a fight like this that you have to constantly remove corruptions in order to keep them from getting out of control. Most toons receive their first corruption removal skills right around level 52, I believe, somewhere in Moria. So I believe that's also about the time where you'll start running into mobs in the game that actually apply corruptions. So let's talk about a few of the skills from the different classes that remove corruptions. And I realize that I have not played all of my classes extensively since the class trait updates, so some of these may have changed. If so, please write in and let me know, and I'll make corrections. So the captain has the improved Blade of Elendil, which removes the corruption. The only problem is it requires two previous skills, typically, to make that skill available. Generally, when you want a corruption removed, you want it removed right away. So Blade of Elendil is a good one to throw in on top of a mob when everyone's removing corruptions, but not for one that you can depend on when it needs to be done quickly and cleanly. There's a couple others that are in that category. So hunters have a melee skill called Improved Dazing Blow that removes three corruptions, I believe, but they have to be in melee range to apply it, which is a downside for a hunter. They also have Improved Merciful Shot, which removes three corruptions, but the mob's required to be under 50% morale when you apply that skill in order for the corruption or for that skill to be available. So again, not the best option all the time. Minstrel has Improved Herald Strike, which removes a corruption, and when you use your Noble Cause so that you get four Herald Strikes in a row, that's a quick way to remove a bunch of corruptions on a mob. But again, you need to be in melee range, someplace a Minstrel generally does not want to be. Can be effective if you can run up to the side or behind a mob and get it off quickly and move out of the way. And then the Minstrel also has the Anthem of the Valar, which removes a corruption, but again, requires three previous skills to build until it's available, so not a best option for quick hits. The Warden has a great corruption removal skill. It's called Reversal, but again, if the Warden's tanking and the mob has a lot of corruptions, you know, they've got to build a gambit to get it off, not a great option. Guardians used to have a skill removal for corruption removal called Sting, which would apply a debuff on the mob where it would remove a corruption after it sat there for 10 seconds. So it was not immediate before. I believe with the class trait changes, that skill Sting is now an immediate corruption removal. So that's a big help for Guardians. The Burglars have two methods. They've got Improved Startling Twist, which removes three corruptions, so a big one, but again, requires them to put a debuff on the mob first that needs to be removed. And also, they can remove from range using... This is the only class I know that has a consumable item, a serrated knife, which is craftable, I believe, by weaponsmiths. So they can use that as a consumable to remove corruptions from range. But again, I think a debuff is required to be on the mob for that to work as well. The Lore Master has always been great at dispelling corruptions. They've got a skill called Dispel Corruption, which is a three corruption ranged removal. Great option. And the Runekeeper is similar with one called Improved Final Word. So I bet there have been some changes that impact some of those. If so, let me know. But hopefully, at least for your class, some of them ring a bell if you're level 52 or higher. There are a couple classic instances requiring corruption removal out there that come to mind. The first one that I always think of is the first boss in Halls of Crafting. Stacks corruptions until he, you know, it used to be a DPS race to get him down before he stacked so many corruptions that he could one-shot your tank. Typically, you know, classes can overpower him now. It's not nearly as challenging as it used to be on level. Used to be a good fight on level, though. The Watcher, of course, a classic example. As you finally get into the last stage of that fight and are surrounding him on the bridge that drops down into the water, the Watcher will build corruptions on a regular basis throughout that fight. And if you don't have all your best corruption removals operating to remove those, again, he'll one-shot your tank or nail your healer or wipe the whole party, basically. So that's an important one. The second boss in Sari Suriyama is a giant that you normally tank off to the side while you burn down all his other giant adds. And I believe he generates a corruption, which if you don't remove it within a certain time limit, something like maybe 10 or 15 seconds, he will unleash an attack which will wipe your party. So everyone, whoever's tanking, needs to be usually on a... usually put into the raid assist panel so that you can monitor him for when that corruption arises and have someone designated to remove it immediately. And maybe one of the craziest ones I've seen before is at the top of Barad Guldur for the lieutenant fight. When you finally get him off his dragon and get him kind of up against the gate for the final part of the fight, there's a number of different mechanics ongoing, but one of the most dangerous is he's got something called a four corruption rotation, which, you know, I've only done this fight a couple times, actually, and it was problematic more than once, where he rotates through four different corruptions during the course of the fight. And some of them are mega. They're all tough, but there are one or two that are mega deadly. So when the really tough ones come up, you have to remove them immediately before the party wipes, and you just deal with the two ones that are of lesser issue until they run out, and he replaces it with one of the tough ones and kind of rinse and repeat. But, you know, I think the first time I was up there when I was tanking the lieutenant and I hadn't been in the fight before, the lead said, well, since you're the tank, you're the best one to monitor the corruptions and call for when they need to be removed. And since I didn't know the fight and I was watching for the fear effect over my head and all the other things that were going on and trying to stay alive, I was not very effective in calling out the corruptions for others to remove because I didn't remember which ones, you know, which colors were the tough ones versus the easy ones. And again, don't recommend it for your first time tank to be pulling that duty. But anyway, those are a number of different instances where corruption removals can be crucial. And there are a number of others. Those are just some of the ones I could think off the top of my head. So hopefully you learned a little bit something about corruption removal that you didn't know before, which brings us to our seventh beacon. Halafirion, the sacred beacon, which according to lore was once the tomb of Elendil. I don't know how they got the support to move the tomb of Elendil to Annúminas and Evendim. Maybe he had a couple of them. Maybe he had like a, you know, a summer tomb, kind of like, for when he was snowbirding or something like that. But, apparently there were a couple spread through Middle-earth. So just so you know. But that brings us to the end of the third episode of Light the Beacons. I'd love to hear your plaudits, feedback, rants, diatribes, and most of all, your constructive critique. You can contact me at bragsonofballin@gmail.com. That's Bragg with two A's. The second A stands for ale. On Facebook at bragsonofballin, my website at lightthebeacons.com, where you can post comments directly on the podcasts. And I kindly request that you take the time to create an iTunes review for me if perchance you are so inclined. I would very much appreciate it. If your comments pass the Turbine Code of Conduct policy, I may include them in the next podcast or at least respond to them in some way. So I hope you laughed either at or with me. I hope you might have learned at least a little something you didn't know before, or perhaps looked at the game with a slightly different perspective. Most of all, I hope you enjoy your time this week in Middle-earth. This is Bragg, son of Balin, signing off. Baruch Kazad. And remember, when the chips are down and you draw Brothers of Destruction and a Primordial Wraith simultaneously while accidentally pulling an encounter in your way of Smith's grade, don't despair. Call Pineleaf. Or light the beacons. Bye-bye.